A very good morning to everyone. Our third member of our panel, Judge Sykes, is ill today and will not be able to join us on the bench. She will listen to the tapes of the oral arguments and will participate in our conference and will be a voting member of the court today, however. We wish her a speedy recovery, and with that, I think we can begin the day's work. The first case is number 07-2311, the Village of Depew, Illinois, against ExxonMobil et al. Mr. Stegall. C. Stegall.
Thank you, Judge Ripple. Judge Tender, I understand. Congratulations on the recent movement. This began as a municipal ordinance action against ExxonMobil and Viacom CBS involving the 23rd worst toxic waste site in the United States. ExxonMobil and Viacom CBS removed on diversity of citizenship, jurisdiction as far as complete diversity, amount of controversy, timely removal is undisputedly exists. I apologize. It was difficult for me in writing the brief to think of CBS as a operations company rather than a broadcasting company, but my adversary corrected that, and he certainly knows the corporate structure. I don't think the name was material. There are two subjects for the court's review. Did the federal court have jurisdiction, and was it the appropriate forum? And secondly, if it did, does the statutory prohibitions of the federal judicial review of EPA cleanup orders until completion of Section 113H of CERCLA mean what it says and doesn't preempt state actions to enforce state law? The district court's jurisdiction under Younger versus Harrop's abstention is disputed. Now, maybe since it's jurisdictional, I will mention it. We agree that there's de novo review. I rely on a statement of the Supreme Court in Ellis versus Dyson that says Younger versus Harrop's abstention is jurisdictional. The difference would be, of course, waiver would not apply. The court would perform its own searching review of the record to see if abstention is appropriate. So while it's de novo review, that's the subtle difference between our standards. And I think the Supreme Court statement, while not directly applicable in the case, it's considered dictum that should be followed. The next issue is, does removal, Judge McDade denied the village's motion to remand because his first ground was that, well, Younger versus Harris abstention involved a criminal prosecution. This is a municipal nuisance action. And with all due respect to the very experienced district judge, I mean, the Supreme Court said in Huffman versus Pursue, 1976, that a municipal nuisance action involves the same significant state interest as a criminal prosecution that requires abstention under Younger versus Harris. So that was obviously, he's just wrong. The next part of his decision was he used another ground, and he says, well, the removal of the action eliminates state proceeding. So, therefore, there isn't any ongoing state proceeding for Younger versus Harris abstention to apply. Well, if you take that to its logical conclusion in criminal cases, for example, just remove it, and then you eliminate the ongoing prosecution, and you undermine Younger versus Harris, any of the other significant state interests, well, you can just remove it, and as long as you qualify under the removal statute, that ends Younger versus Harris.
There was an earlier state action, was there not, that ended up in a consent decree?
Yes.
I would imagine the state court has continuing jurisdiction over the administration of that consent decree?
Certainly, and in fact, Your Honor, it is stated in the order itself that it reserves all jurisdiction.
So in a sense, there is a continuing state action pending in state court.
Yes, of course.
That first state action.
Yes, sir. There is, and it is a consent decree, and this comes up later in the interpretation of as a contract, but it is a judgment, and so it certainly has jurisdiction to enforce its prior order, and it is the most appropriate jurisdiction to do that under the prior judgment. Also, the Supreme Court has said in two cases I cite in the brief, well, similar to this in that one case was involved, I think, Deep Throat or an adult film, and there were prosecutions against the individual employees but not the actual corporation, and they said, well, it's imminent, that's sufficient. Another case was similar, the supplementary proceedings, the man had been jailed, but the contempt citation had not been adjudicated, and they said, well, you've got an ongoing state proceeding. So it's a functional approach rather than a literal. So I think, as you say, this is ongoing state proceeding with the consent decree certainly establishes that element beyond the removal.
The plaintiffs here are not party to that consent decree.
Of course, but it does involve interpretation of that, and you certainly part of it is an interpretation of what it affects.
The possibility of conflicting judgments?
There could be, yes.
How would that work? Could you explain that a little?
Well, for one thing, and I get into this a little on a section, addressed it in a section 113H preemption, is there's a significant matter of state law. Does the Illinois Environmental Protection Statutes, generally, there's several of them put together, preempt municipal nuisance actions? And I cited a Casper case where that's not an appropriate matter for federal decision unless you can't avoid it on a federal question case. So, yes, there is that danger in that, that ultimately that's a matter more reserved for them. I'll reserve the question, though, Judge Ripple. I want to think about it for rebuttal because I'm not answering it direct. And I think that's something I just need some more thought, if you'll forgive me. So then the second issue is Section 113H of if there is jurisdiction, and Younger versus Harris abstention is not appropriate. And frankly, I don't see how it can be avoided in this case, unless you would use the removal action to say, well, oh, the removal action takes the case from state court. Well, there's no longer a state action, even though the federal court can remand immediately back to let that go. I don't see the difference between that situation and a parallel prosecution or some sort of ordinance proceeding, significant state interest. I just say it's a distinction without a difference. And the principles are vital. Federalism principles are more broad. But then we get into, and importantly for this case, is whether Section 113H, which withdraws federal court jurisdiction from reviewing any EPA cleanup order, includes state jurisdiction or to enforce state laws. Well, I look at this and I start off, well, the statute means what it says. Congress is certainly aware of state court jurisdiction. An omission of a term in a statute must be given effect, because they could have said no federal or state, or no court shall have jurisdiction. So we start with the language, and then when you look at the background of the statute, the Superfund CERCLA statute was passed in 1980. Congress looked at it in 85, and the response of the EPA and industry was, well, it's working well. Well, only 12 sites had been looked at, and Congress was naturally outraged. So the whole purpose of Section 113H was to stop industry challenges to EPA ordered cleanup. Well, the purpose of those amendments is to get the toxic site cleaned up. And the language, omission of state court jurisdiction, makes eminent sense with the statutory purposes. If you can put pressure on them in any way from a state court and a state statute, do it, because the purpose of this is, the amendments are, to get these things cleaned up. Congress was well aware, and it was well documented, the agency capture where the regulated become the regulated, and they thought it was too cozy. So you want as many forces to bear. That's why I cite the United States versus Colorado 10th Circuit case involving the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. Now, that involves the U.S. Army, which the CERCLA had also subjected to. There wasn't any sovereign immunity problems, and the 10th Circuit held, well, Section 113H doesn't involve the Colorado state court actions to enforce Colorado's own cleanup, to clean up this notorious nuclear waste site. So there just isn't any other way to read Section 113H but as not including state court jurisdiction. The third item, the other item I would talk about was, at oral argument, Judge McDade considered is, well, does this municipal 750-day penalty, and I use the ordinance uses the words fines, but I think in the sense this court's been involved in constitutional, it's not a criminal fine. It's a civil penalty. And he says, well, is this a damage action which Section 113H accepts? Now, Judge McDade ultimately ruled, well, they didn't pursue it at oral argument, and I submit to you that I had the joys when writing this brief, when the Bell Atlantic case come down, of reexamining our pleading doctrines, but I see that the court has just recently agreed with the position I had, that really what it's emphasizing is you have to have the factual background to give them notice, and then you consider the claims like you always have. Well, there wasn't any formal waiver there, so the court was obligated to give them the benefit of imagination. And certainly you could classify this at the complaint stage as a damage action. Now, if there's some objection to the 750-day civil penalty, it's much simpler for this 1,200-person village. I mean, certainly go down and get into finding out the true value of destroying a town. And get appraisers and all that. This is a simple computation of damage, and if it ultimately doesn't work, that's for further proceedings. But that's another ground to say it's accepted. I would make one correction. I didn't think out in the future in the 21st century, and when I did the calculations on when this would be completed at its current pace, 40 acres over 10 years, I referred to... I put it in terms of millennia rather than actual 100 years. It would be 2496. It would be 300 years from now where this would be completed, not 3,000. I said 2096, but it's 100 years out, and it's 300 years. It would be 2496 at the pace it's going that this would be completed. 1,200-acre site, they've only had 40 acres completed in 10 years. Certainly, this is exactly what Congress was doing with Section 113H, is we have to get these things stopped. And the more pressure that can be brought to bear through citizen damage suits, state actions, the better. And if there aren't any questions, I'll reserve my time.
Thank you, Mr. Stegall.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Lilly.
Good morning. Mark Lilly on behalf of Defendants Appellees. I'm joined by Mr. Henry Ibsen here at council table today. May it please the court. I'd like to reset the argument a little bit and go back to some background very briefly. It's important to stress that this matter comes before the court on a completely undisputed record. There are no disputed issues of fact which the appellee is urging before this court right now. And among the facts in this undisputed factual record, the most important is the 100-page consent order, interim consent order, or ICO, that was entered into between the defendants and the state several years ago. That order sets out in laborious detail exactly, pursuant to the statutory provisions in Illinois law, embodying federal law, how this cleanup is supposed to be conducted. An important last point is that it's simply undisputed before this court that these defendants are in compliance with that order. There's no allegation whatsoever that we are somehow not being faithful in complying with that 100-page interim consent order. Now, in stark contrast to that 100-page embodiment of state and federal law, we have here the village's notice of abatement. And the village hasn't spoken a lot about this, either in its briefs or in argument, but it's important to come back to its language because it says in the notice of abatement, defendants must have the materials removed and the site cleaned of any and all contaminants to the satisfaction of the village board within 10 days. And in their complaint, in the prayer for relief, they go further. They seek an injunction against these defendants to, quote, remove the pile of pollutants on the plant site, close quote, and to, quote, immediately complete a Superfund project, close quote. This nuisance action and the related prayer for relief is an unprecedented and an impermissible attempt by the village to substitute its judgment for that of the legislatively mandated experts, the IEPA. The district court held that that was wrong, that it was not in compliance with state and federal law, and on that basis dismissed the claim.
Mr. Lilly, doesn't the statutory scheme allow, however, for some kinds of nuisance actions to be brought?
It absolutely does, Your Honor.
Well, can you help me with this then? I can see your point as to how this could be disruptive of the state's efforts to clean up the site. But doesn't the statute certainly allows some kind of local participation, disruption, if you will, by the use of nuisance suits? Where's the line?
Your Honor is absolutely correct that under CERCLA and under state law, nuisance actions may proceed, provided that they don't conflict with the ongoing remedy.
So this is I'm sorry, sir, go ahead.
And let me give you an example. For instance, if the village were to enact an ordinance that said, let me back up. Suppose under federal OSHA law that when trucks remove contaminants from an area, they are supposed to proceed at 30 miles an hour. And in its judgment, suppose the village of DePew says, we don't like 30-mile-an-hour speed limits through our town. That speed limit ought to be 10. Certainly, it would have the ability to enforce that kind of a local ordinance. Or if, for instance, the cleanup required machinery that was very loud, it needed to be done, but the village would have, under its nuisance authority, the ability to regulate perhaps the hours during which that loud equipment would be used so as to minimize noise.
What kind of a test, what kind of a principle would you articulate as forming that boundary between impermissible nuisance suits and impermissible nuisance suits? It seems to us, I mean, it seems to me at least, that's one of the things we're going to have to do when we write this out.
I think you're right, Your Honor, and one of the areas in which that answer is drawn comes from the cases that interpret what does it mean to challenge a remedy under Section 113H. And I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but let me go to that right now. Under 113H, under federal law, it is a broad prohibition against against third-party interference with an ongoing cleanup. And if that interference, if that proposed remedy interferes or impacts or it calls into question what the defendants or the government are doing, or even if it tries to dictate remedial action and alter the method and order of the cleanup, that's the Rosori case. As a matter of legislative policy, the Congress has determined it's more important to have a cohesive, unified cleanup program than to permit piecemeal municipal ordinances like the Village of DePue does here.
Sorry, I didn't hear the case you cited.
It's the Razori case. It's a Ninth Circuit case, I believe.
So would I be correct in saying that in the long term, or rather at bottom, you view this case as basically a state preemption case? In other words, you've got state nuisance law, you've got state environmental law, and the issue really is under what circumstances does the state environmental law preempt the state nuisance law?
That is correct, Your Honor.
That's the basic thing that you're worried about in this case.
That is one of the basic things, and it applies to federal law as well under 113H. I think that the outcome is the same. Whether we urge under 113H or we urge under state preemption law, the outcome is the same. There has been a legislative choice, a considered cost-benefit analysis made by the state of Illinois and by the United States Congress that says remediation trumps litigation. In some cases, that may mean that judicial review of an action is delayed. And that is a policy choice that the Congress and the state has made, and the courts have interpreted it that way in many different cases. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
I'd like to now turn to the Younger issue for just a minute. The district court was correct in denying remand under Younger. We don't have the chemistry here that is needed for a Younger case. We don't have the situation where there is an existing case against a defendant, and that defendant then tries to run to federal court to block that state court action. That's not what we have here at all. And Your Honor asked the question about, well, don't we have a pending state court case? We do have a pending state court case, but as you also pointed out, it's between different parties. So that doesn't satisfy the pending state action requirement under Younger. And in counsel's argument, he has not rebutted in any meaningful way the number of cases that we have cited, which make this very clear. It's black and white law. If you have a diversity case, and that pending state case is removed, upon the removal, there is no pending state case for which Younger should abstain in favor of. That is very clear. I think we cite between district court cases and circuit court cases, six or seven cases that support that holding. And that makes sense. It makes absolute sense. Because in this removal action, what we have is two defendants exercising their constitutional right to remove under diversity jurisdiction. We don't have the situation where we are trying to somehow block the state court action by running to federal court first.
And I'm curious, Mr. Lilly, why didn't your clients go back to that Bureau County Court that entered the consent order and seek to enjoin the competing nuisance action?
We didn't think that we needed to, Your Honor. We thought that the case here was legally infirm from the get-go. The Village of DePue case, as brought here, is infirm under state law because that state law is preempted. It's barred under federal law under 113H, and so there was no reason for us to go back to that separate action and seek some kind of involvement with DePue there. Counsel mentioned that there was an issue of forum selection. The court dispatched with that issue very well below in concluding really for two reasons that it didn't apply. First, the forum selection clause or the retention of jurisdiction clause, two different sides of the same coin really, in the ICO, didn't apply here because the Village of DePue is not a party to the consent order. It had no standing whatsoever to invoke either of those provisions. Secondly, the forum selection clause and the retention of jurisdiction speak to interpreting, enforcing, or implementing the terms of the ICO. That's not what's happening here. The nuisance action is completely different from any attempt to enforce, implement, or interpret the ICO, and therefore that doesn't bar federal jurisdiction. I'd like to spend a couple minutes focusing on an issue that has gotten very little attention in the briefs and no attention in the opening part of the argument. We urge a 113H bar and a basis upon which this dismissal is appropriate, but there's a completely separate and completely independent basis upon which the court could affirm the 12B6 dismissal, and that has to do with the state preemption claim. That was not addressed here, and it's not addressed in any length at all in the briefs by the appellant. The state legislature has made it very clear that while a municipality may enact nuisance ordinance, if that nuisance ordinance is in any way in conflict with the IEPA, the Illinois Environmental Protection Act, it is preempted. And as the Hawthorne case says, where there is a conflict between a statute and an ordinance, the ordinance must give way. And that's exactly the situation we have here, because the state legislature, in enacting the Environmental Protection Act, has made it very clear, and this comes from the Carpentersville Supreme Court case, that the intent was to preempt non-home rule regulations. Now, clearly, as we've talked about, a local government can define and abate nuisances so long as they don't conflict with the state statute. And we cite in support of that the Hawthorne case, the Desplaines case, the pesticide case, and Kendall. Kendall perhaps says it best, although in the context of a zoning ordinance. It's impossible to have a unified system of environmental control if counties can subvert the agency with restrictive zoning ordinances. And that's precisely the situation we have here. Imagine the complete frustration of the intent of the IEPA if every municipality in Illinois were permitted to enact its own ordinance on its own terms, with its own definitions, seeking immediate cleanup. We would have regulatory chaos. That is not necessary. It's obviously undesirable, and it's not a necessary result under the reading of the cases.
Is Plains' case also, though, talked about the authority of a municipality to take care of a nuisance within its borders as opposed to trying to influence state regulatory action beyond the borders of the municipality?
It did. And here's a perfect example of the distinction. If the village of Depew, as it does, asks for the immediate removal of this material, where's it going to go? If it's put into trucks and hauled 10 miles down the road to another municipality, you have now left the boundaries of the village of Depew, and you've now moved that problem to another municipality. And that's precisely the kind of it flies completely in the face of the statewide, comprehensive, unified approach that the IEPA is seeking to.
So the pace of the removal you regard as part of the removal process. Is the pace of the removal and what happens to the stuff when it leaves, is that actually in the consent decree?
It is, Your Honor, because the consent decree stipulates a very defined set of steps that have to be done. Some of those steps have been completed here. Others remain yet to be done.
Is the entire site within the corporate limits of this municipality?
I think it is, Your Honor. The district court was correct in concluding that the village ordinance and the request for declaratory relief was in square conflict with Illinois law. On the one hand, the village seeks to have sole authority to decide the remedy. That's in square conflict with what the statute says, that the IEPA has that sole authority. It's in stark contrast when they ask for the immediate cleanup of undefined pollutants as opposed to the step-by-step process that the IEPA stipulates. And the district court specified at least four different statutory and code provisions in which what the village seeks here was in direct conflict with Illinois law. As I mentioned, the court can affirm the dismissal on this basis alone. Now, with respect to the timing of review provision under 12b-6, this court has interpreted section 113H as a bar to challenges of a CERCLA remedy before that remedy is complete. That's the situation that we have here. I alluded to this before, but one of the tests for imposing or invoking Section 113H is that there has to be a challenge. And what constitutes that challenge? This has been looked at from a variety of perspectives. And I think by any measure, when you take a look at what the village asked for here, that constituted interference, or it impacted, or it attempted to dictate the remedy that the IEPA had chosen and implemented in the ICO. And that's precisely what the judge found below. Counsel has spoken about the fine or the damages. First, the village did not make this argument below that in some way the $750 per day fine constituted a damage which was separate from and not barred by Section 113H. But the district court nailed this right on the head. The district court interpreted that as what it really was. And what it really was an attempt to coerce these defendants into complying with the mandatory injunctive relief that they were seeking. And in that sense, it was no different from the things that are barred under Section 113H. This issue has been addressed in at least one circuit court case, and that is New Mexico versus General Electric, which we cite. And what that case stands for is that you can't use the threat of money damages to indirectly force mandatory injunctive relief. We have made clear in our brief, particularly at pages 27 and 28, that state law claims are barred if they are inconsistent with the CERCLA remedy. The Ludwig case, although it's a district court case from the Northern District, is precisely on point, and it compels that conclusion. We cite at least one, if not two, other circuit court cases, albeit not from the Seventh Circuit, that stand for that same proposition, particularly the Beck case. And finally, I would refer the court to perhaps, again, the other side of the coin of the same issue as 113H, and that is, suppose 113H doesn't apply, but you still have a municipality attempting to impose a remedy in a CERCLA environmental cleanup context. If that remedy is different from what is stipulated under federal law, it is preempted, even though 113H may not apply. And it comes to the same conclusion, if you will, as a 113H analysis. It just doesn't invoke 113H. And that's the Fireman's Fund case and the City and County of Denver case. Are there any questions from the panel?
Apparently not, sir.
Thank you. We respectfully urge the court to affirm the denial of the remand motion and to affirm Judge McDade's 12B6 ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lilly. How much time does Mr. Stegall have? Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. In answer to your question about conflicting judgments, I thought it out during my friend's argument, and one conflicting judgment would be if you accept ExxonMobil Viacom CBS's argument that we'll strictly construe the pleadings, that this was just an abatement action. The terms of the pleadings are inconsistent with Illinois EPA involvement, so therefore they're out of court. Well, what happens if the village then does bring a damage action? I mean, was that actually litigated here? That's puts the state judge or if there would in a very difficult situation with complex issues of collateral estoppel, and frankly gives me a headache to think about it, having encountered those before. That answers the second question. In state court, the defense would have been preemption, the fact pleading, move to dismiss. We would have had to admit, but they chose the federal forum. We're not stuck with the labels, and let's face it, this municipality drafted their typical nuisance complaint. Well, they could have amended it in state court as if they knew, or their lawyer knew, and in federal court they don't have to. You don't have to plead a legal theory. Okay, so obviously they're not going, the village of DePue does not have the expertise and never has claimed the expertise below or here to tell ExxonMobil, Viacom, CVS how to clean this thing up. But after 10, 11 years, enough is enough. To get this done, let you come in and prove your defenses that this conflicts with the EPA and the Illinois EPA. The case, Carpentersville, was later distinguished in the Lily Lake case, the state Supreme Court case. It's saying that involves a specific EPA permit. Now, this record isn't developed into the facts of what permit and the technicalities of this, whether there is actual conflict. And I do not, for the life of me, understand on this record, or however, a municipality saying 10 years is enough. You got to get something going on this. They've been very patient. Okay, you don't want to. You're a corporation. The only way we know to do anything is, okay, pay us. And maybe that'll up the economic ante and make you do something. At the very least, they have the right to have ExxonMobil, Viacom, CBS prove how this conflicts with the Illinois EPA specific orders or the EPA. Saying it doesn't make it so. This wasn't complete preemption. They didn't remove on that basis, and it's never been argued. So it's preemption defense. Well, they want to litigate that defense on a Rule 12b-6 motion. It's just not clear from that this couldn't be consistent. And, in fact, the general concept is if they're dragging their feet, the state bureaucracy is not moving, the federal bureaucracy is not, well, the people living there can get everybody's attention. Come in and tell us why this does not conflict. Now, the other important thing this is a judgment, this interim consent decree. And in that interim consent decree, in the judgment, they did specifically agree to be bound by the strictest law when there's conflicts of federal, state, and local. Again, you cannot make this decision. This court, and the district court didn't attempt to, on the record before it, is, well, is this more strict regulation to say, you got to move this up? How does this really conflict? Wouldn't it be wonderful for everybody concerned in this blighted site and the public at large to have ExxonMobil, Viacom, CBS say, well, yes, the EPA, this is how it conflicts. And then we would actually hear what they presented to the EPA and might even hear from the EPA or the Illinois EPA and get this out in the open at an evidentiary hearing or certainly a legal argument. But if, as the way it stands, their view is, we say it preempts. We have this consent decree that, my gosh, I've referred to the Recorder of Deeds numbers, which I would recommend to the court to try and parse it as big as it is, because there's three different ways they refer to it. As you look at the Recorder of Deed numbers, you got to have a hearing on this. You can't just say, well, 110 pages, there's a conflict. I go back to Younger versus Harris. The point, and I did make it in my reply brief, that the cases they cite, that it's clear that Younger versus Harris abstention is affected by removal, and it's no bar, involve Colorado River abstention. Of course it does in Colorado River abstention. That's a judicial administration doctrine. The removal statute allows you to remove. There's no other action to parallel action to conflict. That's different when you're trying to oust the state court of its jurisdiction by the removal statute. So if there are no questions, I thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. The court would like to thank both Mr. Stiegel and Mr. Lilly for their very fine presentations today, and the case will be taken under advisement.